Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. I'm Stephen Duca, Director of Tate Britain. I just wanted to welcome you to this latest in our series of BP artist talks. I'm sure some of you attend these quite regularly, and I suppose the more usual format is actually an artist talking on their own. Well, it's, if you think about it, a much more natural format when an artist is talking to someone, and so we're delighted that Peter Blake is here this evening in conversation with Marco Livingstone. I mean, Peter is so celebrated, isn't he, that you don't really need me to give you a potted history of his career. He actually labours these days under the burden, doesn't he, of being a national treasure. It must be, and I think it really is a burden. And I'm sure people are used to putting you into boxes which you may or may not enjoy. I mean, whether it's, you know, that the usual cliche, the godfather of British pop, or Sergeant Pepper artist, to people who work in the Tate shop, actually. He's, you know, he's the painter who does the self-portrait with badges, 1961, that great work, which I think is always amongst our, you know, our best-selling postcards. And perhaps to a younger generation, those who know his work and learned about his work, particularly through the Tate's big retrospective held at Liverpool 2 years ago, he may be known, I don't know, as the artist of that the Marcel Duchamp World Tour series, or many other ways into his career, many other ways that his art and his life can be reduced to a few words. I'm sure you rightly resist those badges, in fact. And if you want to know more about his work after this evening, I'm sure you're going to want to buy the incredible new book that has been published, written by Marco Livingstone, will be on sale later this evening, signed copies available. It really is. It goes slightly against the grain, I have to say, for me to be promoting a book published by Lund Humphreys rather than by Tate Publishing. But never mind, it is an extraordinary book. And it's really great to have both subject and author here tonight. So without further ado, I'm going to hand over to Marco Livingstone and Peter Blake.
Good evening. Could we have... Thank you. This is going to be a very unrehearsed conversation. Peter and I have known each other 25, 26 years now, and we meet every so often. Sometimes we have proper interviews. Sometimes we just have chit-chat like anybody else. Tonight, I thought the best way to keep it fresh for everybody would be for me not to tell Peter what images I've brought or what I plan to ask him about. In the spirit of a famous quip by Bob Hope, who was asked, would he like to be cremated or buried? And he said, surprise me. When I set about writing the book, we'd been talking about doing this book since 1990, and in the intervening 18 years before I finally got around to writing it for the publisher who was going to do it in the right way, I completely changed my ideas about how I was going to do it. But from the beginning, I knew that a straightforward chronological approach wasn't going to work, because Peter works in so many different ways and so many different forms simultaneously and keeps them all going all the time, that it would make very little sense to go year by year, constantly returning to themes and seeing how he's updating them. So the book is structured on various themes, loosely chronologically. I didn't want to repeat that structure in this talk, but what I did want to do was to begin with what Peter always says is the main thread running through his work, where he describes his art as a kind of tree, and the trunk of that tree being straightforward figurative painting. So we have here on the screen a self-portrait and RAF jacket, which he made in around 1952 or 3 when he was 20 years old. And perhaps you just start by telling us about the art training you had immediately prior to going into national service.
Yes, I went to art school at the age of 14 to a junior art department, and that came about because I got I got an interview to go to a local technical school, And when I went for that interview, they said, if you want to go to the art school, you just go around the corner to the art school, do a test, and you might get in there. So I was kind of presented with being an art student very suddenly. So, and until then, I mean, we won't go into the time before that, but the 7 years before that had been the 7 years of the Second World War. So I went to art school in 1946 at the age of 14 and really started completely, with a completely new start from there. So my education from then was 3 years at junior art department, a year doing the intermediate examination, which in 1950 had been going for 150 years, and it ended that year and took a new form. And then I did a year, I wanted to then become a painter, and the tutors at Gravesend said, you'll never make a living as a painter, do the commercial art course. So I did a year of that, tried for the Royal College halfway through for the illustration school, and Robin Darwin, who was the rector at that point, saw I'd sent one painting, and they accepted me to the painting school. And then I did National Service. So in 1953, I arrived at the painting school, never having really been a painter. And this was done during the 2 years of National Service. And I think is almost a kind of cry for help, you know, that I'm wearing the RAF jacket, but wearing Harley Quinn trousers. So it must be wishing for it to be over, kind of thing.
But you have talked about how being in the RAF took you away from your shyness, the crippling shyness that you noted as a child. One of the things that struck me when I was writing the book and also listening to the interviews you'd done for the National Sound Archive at the British Library, talking about your early life, is just how disruptive the war was on your childhood, and you were 7 years away from your family, evacuated on two different occasions. And it seems to me that that's something that you return to over and over again, the loss of your childhood and the wish to return to that state of grace that you missed out on. And it's something that is apparent in a work such as this, The Children Reading Comics of 1954. You were 22 then, but you were remembering what it was like as a child entertaining yourself, as you did in other pictures, such as the ABC Miners, yeah, where you're going to the cinema.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. And I think what happened, you know, was that at the Royal College, you had to do a compulsory year in the life room, drawing or painting from the model, and then suddenly you were more or less told, right, go off and paint. So again, there was a second new start. You having done 1 year of further training, as it were, and suddenly you're thinking, well, what shall I paint? And at that point, I think that element came into the work, and they became very autobiographical. And I suppose I started to record the bit of life I'd missed, and childhood in general.
The two images that we've seen so far, and this one as well, all have the same kind of frontality. The person in the picture just standing, looking straight ahead back at the viewer. And that's also something that remains a constant in your work. There's something about that very frank gaze, the way of addressing the spectator. Why do you think that occurred so early in your work?
I think it must be based on photography, you know, the fact that a lot of the paintings are done from existing photographs, you know, when the person would have been looking straight into a camera, which is an unnatural scenario, really. But you're looking at the camera and being captured in that way. So, but there were other artists that I was beginning to like and be influenced by, people like Ben Shahn and the American Magic Realist group, who did something very similar. There was particularly an artist called Anna Shara, who painted exactly. She painted a picture called Workers and Paintings, which in fact should have been shown right here at the Tate in 56 and was taken out of the American show. It was banned for being too political, but it depicted working class people holding up things like Picasso's. So it was making some kind of comment on class. And I think pictures like that influenced me very much, particularly Ben Shahn, I think.
In this particular picture, which relates to your cinema going as a child, you were taken by your mother from a very early age to the cinema, and it was maybe not an obsession, but certainly one of the amusements that you were most fond of, and that you added to later with wrestling matches and jazz clubs and so forth. The cinema has been another recurring theme in your work. There have been portraits of film stars. They've appeared on covers of some of the records you've designed. How do you see your role as a fine artist in relation to that kind of entertainment industry? Because you've always made pictures that are very accessible to a general audience, and they've often had a narrative in them. So they do link with a kind of motion picture industry.
Yeah, it probably is very much based on my mother taking me to the cinema. I suppose she would have gone most afternoons, and by the time I was old enough to be taken, I think from the age of about two, I spent most afternoons in cinemas, in that kind of dark, wonderful atmosphere. So I would have seen Shirley Temple films as they were made. In fact, my mother joined me into the Shirley Temple fan club. And I think I still have the card somewhere.
My brother.
So I would have been brought up in this world of fantasy. I mean, the early Disney films would have been coming out, Snow White and Fantasia and Bambi and Dumbo and those films. And I would have been seeing them as a child. Mm-hmm. And then later on, I think my work often is about celebration. So I'm often simply saying, this is a person I like. Like Marilyn Monroe or Kim Novak or whoever it might be. I'm just presenting them and saying, this is a painting of somebody that I admire very much.
But there's also a lot of fantasy in your own work, in your own inventions. So do you think that kind of fantasy world of the cinema fueled your own imagination to create your own stories?
Yeah, I think what the cinema does is makes a kind of magic possible, but also the magic realists in America were doing a very similar thing. They were painting a kind of surrealism, but without the trappings of surrealism, so without melting clocks and things like that. But they were painting surrealist situations, and I think quite often in the cinema, that's what's happening. You're an unlikely situation, and quite often later paintings do definitely pick up on that possibility.
You've said that The Wizard of Oz is one of your favourite films, but you've never made a picture based on it, even though you've made pictures based on favourite books, like the Lewis Carroll Alice books.
No, Dorothy recurs in quite a lot of sculptures. And this was a question, were we talking about this the other day? This was a question that came up inquiring, why I'd painted Snow White and Dorothy. And it was an answer I had to come up with. And the answer was pretty much that I suppose it's a fascination with girls going into womanhood. So it's the idea of the woman girl and the girl woman. You had that kind of crossover point. And it includes Snow White and Dorothy and Alice and Tuesday Weld. So it's an interest in that phenomenon, that moment.
Was that a conscious thing, or is that in retrospect?
I think unconscious. No, I think it just... Balthus did a very similar thing. I think at the time it was unconscious.
Quite often there seems to be an identification on your part with the characters you're depicting, which we'll see later on with some of the wrestlers. How does that work if the character is Snow White? And do you feel an identification, or is that just a character that you enjoy.
But I'm not the prince, and I'm not the wicked mother, and I'm not Snow White. No, I think I'm just standing back. I mean, what a great character she is. I mean, living with seven dwarves and all of that. I mean, she's just a big person.
And you collect postcards of dwarves as well?
I collect, just before Woolworths closed, it was my main supply of Snow White plastic dolls, which I've got a collection of.
This is a painting called On the Balcony from 1955 to 7. You were still at the Royal College when you started this. You finished it after a year of traveling around Europe. It's what I refer to in the book as a subject painting. And in fact, it was a subject that was given to you at the college. So quite a few of your pictures over the years have been spurred by some outside factor, especially the commissioned work, which you've done for album covers. To what extent do you like having ideas proposed to you and then to find your own quirky solution to them?
Well, I think there are almost two questions there. I mean, to answer that one very simply, what's exciting at the moment is the idea of working on a painting which might go over 3, 5, 10 years, in some cases, as you know, 20 years with A Portrait of Hockney. So I like that longevity, but I also like the idea now that I can be commissioned to do something, and working at Coriander Studios, I can go in and in a day, I can, sometimes in an hour, make a piece. So I very much like that contrast. But to go back to the first question, this was at the Royal College between the second and third years, as part of your diploma, you were set a picture to paint and you were partly judged on that. And the two subjects this year, the year on the balcony, were On the Balcony and The Story of Lot. And I chose On the Balcony. And then on thinking about it, I thought, well, do it as a presentation of as many verses of On the Balcony you can think of. So they're all different versions of On the Balcony, including the little girl standing on the table who's holding Romeo and Juliet, so who is playing at being Juliet. So there are all kinds of references to On the Balcony.
You like making categories of things. You do that as a collector. You do that in your collages. You collect together material and different subjects, which you're going to then use for works that are just in a rough planning stage. Is there a certain kind of... what is it about putting things in categories that appeals to you so much and finding variations like that?
I think I just love lists. I mean, in the way that Ian Dury loved lists and Cole Porter wrote songs about lists, I just love having a piece of paper and a pen and listing things. I think it's probably a common trait.
I mean, it also gave you, in this instance, an excuse for engaging in lots of different kinds of painting, which is something else you like to do, so that you're not limited by one method of representation. So on the excuse of it being this assortment of different people carrying different pictures, you've got the Manet, for example, there. You've got paintings made in the style of other artists. You've actually got works made by other artists in this picture as well.
I mean, it's something that probably developed from this picture into just a general interest in the ways of making art, different ways of making art, and art referring to other art and transcriptions and appropriations and things like that. But to take a few elements from this picture, the picture right in the middle, the black and white picture is as though by Richard Smith at the time, and the one underneath the royal family is as though by Robin Denny at the time, and Robin had borrowed Dick's set of stencils and did a whole series of pictures using stencils, and they were at the forefront of the kind of British Abstract Expressionist
painting. And they were fellow students at the Royal College.
They were in the year after me. My fellow students, the immediate fellow students in the year before was Frank Auerbach and Joe Chilson, and the kitchen sink painters had just left. So Bratby stayed on for a fourth year, so he overlapped. And then in the year after me, in my year, was Leon Kossoff and David Troostwyck and others. And then in the year after was Dick Smith and Robin Denny, Bill Green and that generation. So that places me at that point. And then there are, there's the Manet on the left. I told the story the other day doing a lecture that the picture at the bottom right of the man with the black beard, when I was painting, you mentioned the fact that I worked on it for that summer. And then when I came back from the scholarship, I moved back into my parents' home in Dartford. And my brother was watching me paint one day, and he said, "Can I do a bit?" And I said, "Yeah, paint that bit." So that is a painting by my brother. at the age of about 14, I should think. And then there are the one at the bottom in the middle. It was a gently spiteful kind of look at Leon, who I presumed would go back and paint a scene from the story of Lot, and it would be very thick paint. And the frame would probably be made rather badly on purpose. So it's very thick paint. It's a gentle, I suppose eventually it's a kind of homage to Leon Kossoff, isn't it? But at the time it was assuming what he might do. He did, almost exactly.
The thing is, at the time, and probably for quite a long time, the fact that you played with style in that way and worked in so many different styles with so many different conventions was held against you by some people who would have seen that as eclectic. In the 1980s, people came up with this notion of postmodernism, and suddenly you were 30 years ahead of the game because you'd been quoting style in that very self-conscious way. And then it became all right and acceptable. Mm-hmm. You've always gone your own way and not worried too much about what everyone else was doing around you. I mean, I'd be curious to know what the other students were doing on the balcony.
They were pretty traditional. It's some almost transcriptions of the Manet. There was nothing quite like this. I don't really remember all of them, but they would have been pretty straightforward versions of a balcony with a personal.
Probably quite a lot of formal exercises, yeah. Extrapolating.
This was 1955, so we were still a generation that had been taught about Cézanne and had been taught how to paint in the kind of Euston Road School and things like that. So a picture like this was pretty much a breakthrough for that situation, although it was running parallel with the magic realist that I mentioned earlier.
Of course, you were also looking at folk art and naive art by this time, and when you got the fellowship, the Leverhulme Award, in 1956 to travel around Europe, it was specifically to study folk art. You went around the folk art museums in the Netherlands and all the way through France and Italy and Spain, picking up bullfight posters and buying postcards and looking at material that was outside of the fine art tradition. And eventually this was one of the ways in which you created your own brand of pop art before it existed as a named movement, which again we're going to come on to a bit later. But this is another picture from that same Royal College period, the preparation for the entry into Jerusalem, which began in the same year, and it was another set subject.
It was the set subject for the Prix de Rome. For the Prix de Rome, you had to paint a particular a set picture, and it was the entry into Jerusalem. So I depicted it by making it be like a kind of Sunday school group who'd gone with a banner of Jerusalem. And the Sunday school teacher with a picture of Jesus on the donkey, and then a child would have the boy standing behind the Mobo Bronco would have then got on it and kind of jerked his way into Jerusalem, and there are palms palms and clothes lying on the path.
There's a deliberate awkwardness in a lot of the early pictures, and both in the way that they're depicted and in the kinds of characters that you show, people who seem slightly ill at ease, shuffling in their clothing, not quite confident enough. I mean, there's probably something of you as a young man in that. Right, yeah. And I wondered whether it wasn't just a temperamental thing, but also a feeling that you had invaded the art establishment by some odd, circuitous routes that you hadn't planned to be an artist, you hadn't planned to go to art school. Did you feel like an interloper in some way, and did you adopt this language deliberately because it was a way of expressing a sense of yourself as an outsider?
Yeah, I think I still do. I mean, I think the fact, as you say, that I didn't grow up through a childhood with any kind of young talent thinking I might go to art school. The fact that it was presented to me in that moment, and then the dichotomy really of I suppose what's interesting is that I did half a graphic design course, so I did the first year, so I'm an ill-informed graphic designer, but I also didn't do that year as a painting student, so I'm this odd hybrid of having learnt a year of graphic design. So I learnt lettering, and in fact my craft for the intermediate was Roman lettering. So I learnt a lot of the skills, but I didn't finish the course. So now I can kind of crash around graphic design and really do quite odd things sometimes. Because I don't know any better.
But you like breaking the rules anyway.
Well, yeah, but it might be it might just be a series of mistakes, maybe. and the same in painting. I used this as an example before. If you take a row of shops, most painters would dip the brush into the canvas, into the paint, and they would just write the name of the shop with the brush. Whereas I would be very aware that a butcher shop would have this sort of lettering, that all the lettering would... You look at any row of shops and the lettering is always different. So I came into painting with an ill-formed graphic designer's mentality.
Or an illustrator.
Yeah, because quite often people have said in a derogatory way, oh, that's very illustrative. And, of course, most of the painting I do is about being illustrative. It's a strength rather than a weakness, but it's considered a weakness.
But this sense of how you became an artist, it wasn't just that by not passing your 11 plus, you found you were going to the technical school, yeah. And then you found that you could do drawing at the art school. But when you applied for a place at the Royal College, you were expecting to be applying for a place in the graphic design department. And do you want to tell the story of how you ended up in the painting school, which you hadn't expected?
Well, I think I mentioned it earlier, but what happened was I sent up my portfolio and I put one painting in it that I'd done with my sister, a very kind of straightforward portrait. And Sir Robin Darwin, who happened to be sort of visiting the examiners that day, saw the folder and said, I'll send it over to the painting school. And the painting school saw it and accepted me as a painter. So it was this very odd route.
But during your childhood, did you draw a lot? Was it a pastime that you enjoyed?
Hardly at all.
It's so strange that you're such a compulsive maker of images now as an adult. You have been since your early 20s. It seems to me very unusual that you weren't already like that.
Well, I don't really want to get too deeply into the war years and the evacuation, but it was a situation in both cases where I wasn't evacuated officially. So in both cases, being evacuated to the Essex-Suffolk borders and then to Worcester to my grandmother, I was very much the only person, the only odd person. There weren't other evacuees. Mm-hmm. So it was an uncomfortable...
But you were with your sister?
With my sister, yeah. But at schools, I mean, there wouldn't have been... The schools I went to, there wouldn't have been good art teachers. Eventually, when I came back to London and did 1 year at I think it was called Dartford West Central, which was a really tough secondary modern school, that there was a very sympathetic headmaster there who probably did guide me towards art at that point. But by then I was 13.
This is one of the pictures for which you're best known, I imagine, and hanging at the moment here at Tate Britain, the self-portrait of the Badgers of 1961. This touches on a lot of the subject matter of pop art, but it's phrased in a deliberately old-fashioned way, which is a kind of paradox that also runs through a lot of your work, where you're being both avant-garde and very traditional at the same time. You're holding an Elvis Presley fanzine, you're wearing all kinds of badges that you were collecting. You've got a denim uniform before that was the fashion among youth in the country, basketball sneakers. But the picture's painted in almost a 19th century naturalistic manner.
Yeah. What more do I say? Yeah, I mean, I agree. I suppose it refers, I realised afterwards, it also refers back to the Watteau painting of the Gillies. That your feet splayed very straightforward, looking at the camera kind of pose. I suppose the other sort of thing that I was doing, which is quite interesting, is that I didn't much like doing hands, so whenever I could avoid it, I'd put a hand in the pocket. So, one hand is painted reasonably well, but the other hand is hidden. But again, it wasn't a set subject, but it was a painting done almost under duress that we were. It was would have been the summer holiday of teaching by then, rather than being a student, but. A group of us decided we would send to the John Moores in 1961, and Robin Denny was going to drive a van up and take the pictures up on the top of the van and a certain day. And I was literally, as they carried it out, I shared a flat with Dick then, and as they carried it out, I was painting on it as it went out of the door. So it was tied to the top of this van for the journey to Liverpool, still wet. So again, it was sort of a painting with limitations. That's right. Why only one of the shoes is painted? There wasn't time to do the other one. But there is this kind of right at the bottom, right through the middle, is this kind of coding of what would have been there if I'd had time to put it there. So quite often there was this thing of time running out.
You've commented on that. Aspect of a lot of your paintings where they look more painterly, more freely painted. In your view, they were just unfinished. We'll probably have some of those coming up a bit later. It's sometimes difficult for the spectator to tell what was deliberate and what was simply circumstance, because you could spend so long on some pictures and that sometimes they're simply taken out of your hands because somebody's decided to buy it, you've exhibited it in that unfinished state. And they've taken it away. This picture is one of the classic examples, the portrait of David Hockney in a Hollywood Spanish interior, which you began in 1965. You showed it intermittently over the years in various pop art exhibitions, among others, in your retrospective here at the Tate in 83. You finally finished it less than 10 years ago, having swapped the painting with David Hockney at the time for a set of his Rake's Progress etchings.
That's right, yeah.
And so it was over 30 years that was in your studio. And when you finally handed it over to him, he very generously made a gift of it to the Tate.
That's right.
It's now here. It's still, in your terms, somewhat unfinished.
It's unaccountable, really, because there's an enormous amount of work in it. You're on the balloons, and I mean, each of those little specks of colour is a carefully painted piece of confetti. Each one might have taken me half a day or something. So looking at it now, I think a lot of the a lot of the energy is misplaced. You know, it could have done without the confetti, and I could have spent more time on the figures. And, and a very good example is the matchbox. I mean, why on earth didn't I finish that matchbox? I made a wooden sculpture of a matchbox, and I traced the lettering on, and I started to paint it, but it's unfinished. I mean, I could have finished it in a day. So there must be this curious... There must be a reason I leave them unfinished.
You can't let go.
But maybe it's a way of holding on to something. I mean, I really can't account for it, seeing a picture like that now.
But I think often the unfinished, more painterly look is very beautiful in your paintings. And perhaps there are some occasions where you've carried on working on something too long, and it's all become very tight.
And it
might have been
better
to have left it at an earlier stage like this.
It's rare that I carry on too long. It's much more usual that things aren't finished.
But by the time you finished this, David had stopped dyeing his hair.
Exactly.
Gone gray.
It didn't look anything like that. I wonder maybe if it might have had something to do with the fact that I shared a flat with Richard Smith, and my immediate contemporaries at the Royal College at that point were the young abstract painters. So when I shared with Dick, I would be in one room with a trebolo sable kind of tickling away. Dick would be up a ladder throwing paint at the canvas. Maybe I wanted to be an abstract expressionist. Because at the bottom of that picture, the dribbles are left, and there is a kind of looseness about it. You maybe it has a tiny bit to do with that.
Well, some of these looser passages remind me of Larry River's work of that time.
Yeah.
And he was in London briefly during that period, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, and we met him then. And whatever he was doing, I was also doing. Whatever reason he had for doing it, I was doing it for the same reason.
Because there was an academic aspect to his work too, which he was playing against.
Absolutely, yeah. And again, it's playing with ways of painting, isn't it? It's commenting on different possibilities. The ultimate, which I aim much more for now, is everything being finished and a complete illusion of realism. All the time you leave it like this, it's about the act of painting. Mm. There are clues. There must be marks on there that were put on the first day I started the picture. So the paint tells the story of the picture being painted. So maybe there's an element of that.
It becomes more about the process.
Yeah,
in some sense. We're jumping ahead here to 1987, to a commissioned portrait of the collector E.J. Power, which I brought in here just to demonstrate that aspect of your work, this kind of straightforward figurative painting, is something that's continued through to this day, and most obviously so in the portraits. But even in this picture, you painted it from a photograph for a start, and then behind him is a fragment of a painting by your friend Patrick Caulfield, which E.J. Power owned. So you're still bringing in different methods of painting within the same picture, but painting them all in the same technique.
Yes, this was a painting painted at lunch at Leslie and Clodagh Waddington's house, and I think at that point they must have owned that Caulfield.
Oh, okay.
And I took the photograph. So I mean, you remember Ted was always kind of waving his finger and declaiming, wasn't he? Wonderful, wonderful man, great collector. And in a way, it's a kind of memorial to him and an homage to him.
We're jumping back here to the mid-1950s, because in parallel with that fairly straightforward naturalistic style, you were also making works in borrowed styles, in the styles of fairground painting, circus painting, barge painting. This is Dixie Darling of the Midway, serial Sheet Devil of Naked Madness, and Loelia, World's Most Tattooed Lady. The whole thing is here an elaborate illusion, as if it had been painted by somebody else and you had adopted the persona of another artist, of an untutored, self-taught artist, which is something that you still enjoy doing. In recent works, you've made collages in the style of Max Ernst and Kurt Schwitters and Anna Höck, for example. So you seem to enjoy displacing yourself, getting outside of your own personality and imagining what it would be like to be a different sort of artist.
Perhaps that refers back a bit to this kind of displacement as a graphic designer, because the lettering there is done quite well. It's a graphic designer type of lettering. But that was actually a new piece of board. It was a brand new panel, which I then poured paint onto and broke away the pieces at the bottom to make it look like planks of wood. I think there's a piece of canvas stuck in the position of the nose. So it was contrived to look like a panel from a fairground ride, and did what we talked about earlier. It was a matter of stepping into another person's shoes and becoming a fairground painter, which I still do. I mean, I still do this kind of role playing now.
I was reading an interview the other day with the actor Penelope Cruz, in which she plays a bad actress and she has to do the same scene badly and well.
Yeah.
And I think in a way you're doing that here. The lettering is a bit wonky. The spacing is funny.
Absolutely.
The way the figure is depicted is rather naive. But there's a skill and sophistication in mimicking badly made things, which might escape the notice of a casual observer.
Yeah, I think there is. There's also an interesting point that comes up. When I was a student at Gravesend, every so often you were given kind of pieces of advice. One which I still can't quite work out was that if a thing isn't going too well, draw a black line around it. And I think that maybe that kind of related to Art Nouveau or something. That was one piece of advice. The other was you can't make a head be actual size. You must choose now whether to make it smaller or larger. For instance, Ben Shahn makes larger. Most sculptors at that point chose to make the head smaller. So Henry Moore heads are often quite small, and those kind of 50 sculptors. So I think the conscious decision I was forced to make was I'll make them bigger. So there's always this kind of oddness about them. I mean, that head is actually, relative to the shoulders, is enormous, isn't it? So it may have been based on this rather silly piece of advice that has coloured my whole career.
The figure on the right is absolutely covered with tattoos, as is this tattooed lady of 1961. The tattoo is another found image and another way of making an image.
Yeah.
And you're constantly searching in your work for different ways of depicting human beings or any subject that you might wish to depict. Would you have found it too constraining, too limiting to have chosen one way of making a picture? Would you have found that suffocating, do you think?
I imagine I would, because I didn't. It's something that I respect a lot. I mean, someone like Frank Auerbach or Leon Kossoff, who can know exactly what they're aiming for and go through life doing it. But I'm not that kind
but
of painter.
Art students are often worried about finding their voice, finding their style, and you are constantly playing with different styles, and you didn't seem too perturbed by that.
No, I think if I had to pin it down, there is a kind of style there, which comes back to the idea of this, the trunk of the tree and being a figurative painter. I think that's what my style is. But then it's adaptable, Then I can make variations on it. I can become a sign writer or wood engraver or whatever I choose to be. Mm. But I think that would be my basic style.
But you also liked doing things that you were told not to do.
Maybe,
being a little bit subversive, and you were told not to work from photographs, and you were told not to trace. So that was an unacceptable way of drawing. And, of course, you've done both consistently all the way through your life. And you've made works in your own voice, they always come out looking like Peter Blake's. No matter where you start, what found image you use, or what pseudo-mechanical procedure you might use with it, your hand is always evident, and your eye, and your particular sense of humor, and so forth. When we come to the pop art proper, this is the fine art bit of 1959, which belongs to the Tate, suddenly all those things we've been looking at go out of the window, and instead of making pictures entirely by your own hand, you begin to incorporate found objects, these postcards that you bought on your travels during that year around Europe, in Girlie Door, pages from magazines of various film stars of the period, Got a Girl, all the different rock and rollers, again from magazines, who had been mentioned in the song from that 45 that's actually attached to the surface. Tuesday Wells, the actress. The first real target where you use an actual store-bought target. And then the toy shop of 1962, also in the Tate, where a large number of objects that you'd collected over the years are encased within this child-sized window through which the viewer peers. It's always intrigued me that it seems like the polar opposite to those other pre-pop pictures, like the children reading comics, which were very much to do with your manual skill and your observational abilities. And suddenly, even the painting that you did by hand is disguised to make it look like a found object. This is household gloss paint, but it looks like something that you might have found ready-made, and you are happy to pass that off as not being your own work. It seemed a very radical step to suddenly take. Now, I know that you would discover the work of Jasper Johns and Robert Rauschenberg, and they, in particular, were important influences in finding this new way of making art.
Yeah, I suppose it's what happens, you know, every so often. Art breaks through in a way, doesn't it? I mean, what Rauschenberg's and Jasper Johns were doing in America was a breakthrough of ways of making a picture. I mean, Rauschenberg would have linked back, for instance, to Schwitters. I mean, there's always a continuum. But at that point in America, what they were doing was really an enormous breakthrough. Andy Warhol beginning to make, you know, the kind of factory-produced, silkscreen paintings. People make breakthroughs, and I think the breakthrough I made, I mean, one of them was simply using primary colours. At that point, it was very unusual to just take a red and yellow and blue. I realise now it was less unusual than I thought, because at the same time, Elsworth Kelly was in Paris doing all that early work about colour, and there's an Elsworth Kelly which is really identical to that was probably done at around the same time. But it was simply a breakthrough, I think, and using enamel paint. I mean, real artists didn't use enamel paint. Fairground artists did. So they were all quite natural breakthroughs.
I mean, soon after this, Patrick Caulfield started using enamel paints.
Yeah.
I'm sure aware of what you've been doing. And in the 90s, Gary Hume returned to that as a material, using household paints, and it's now a very accepted thing. In 1959... there must have been a lot of people who thought that didn't look like art.
Absolutely.
There were no brush marks, no sign of the hand. No,
and I can't account for it. I mean, all I can say, it was a kind of natural breakthrough that happened. I can never quite explain why. I can explain some of the motifs. For instance, the red and yellow diagonal paintings came from, it's still used as a danger sign on the back of lorries. So I'd seen a waste bin at Charing Cross Station and thought, well, that's very beautiful. And you just lifted the idea of the red and yellow diagonal. So it usually comes from somewhere. But it simply was a breakthrough in art. I mean, that's
perhaps because you've always been so open to inspiration from areas outside fine art, it was easy for you to see something like that and think you can use it for painting and not censor yourself and not think that wasn't appropriate.
I think so, yeah.
This is Pin-Up Girl from 1965. It's a return of sorts to that naturalistic way of painting the figure, but using the kind of material that you'd begun to incorporate as collage elements into the pop paintings. So there's a kind of synthesis that begins to take place here. I don't know whether this is a pop picture or not. The collage-based paintings clearly are, and they're among the most radical pop pictures that any artist made here or in the US. And I think you probably still haven't been given enough credit for that in the United States, where they're very protective of their own history, yeah. Where they often do pop art exhibitions where they don't include any British artists. But considering that those were done between 1959 and 61, before Warhol started screen printing the Marilyns in 62, they have a very important place in the early history of that movement. By the time you made a picture like this, and there are other pin-up girls and strippers that you were painting, you're making reference to something from the public domain, to the pin-up image, to pornography, but you're treating her as a human being, which again goes against the spirit of the source material in a way. You humanize her as you do all the characters that you began painting around that time, the wrestlers, the boxers. This is Irish Lord X, 1963, Little Lady Luck of 1965, and Roxy, which you started in 65 and finished in 83.
Which I refer back to in the new book. You know, the print that goes with the limited edition is called Roxy 2, so it's a continue. It's almost like a film, to go back to that point. It's a filmic second version of a different.
Except it hasn't got Sylvester Stallone in it.
No, hasn't got Sylvester.
Roxy 2.
Yeah.
These masked figures in particular, I don't know how personal one should be in these things, but it's been written about before. The bicycle accident that yeah. you had in your teens, and how that contributed to your shyness. You grew a beard at that stage, very young, to as a kind of mask behind yeah. which you could hide and feel more confident. There's a lot of masked figures among your wrestlers, and of course they exist in that area of entertainment, of wrestling as a kind of form of a televised entertainment now. But were you particularly drawn to those characters? Did you see these in particular as alter egos?
Perhaps, yeah. I think it was, maybe it's much more just a general interest in a kind of, in a strata of society. The same people that Diane Arbus photographed, and that so it's people on the edges of society often. But to go back to the pin-up girl, you know, and what I'd said just before then, I think what was interesting again was that the breakthrough was simply a fine artist with the concept of painting a pin-up girl. I mean, the painters have always painted the nude, and were at that point, and there was nothing unusual in that. But I think what was unusual was to say, this is a pin-up girl. The idea of this is the same concept as buying a calendar, or the calendar you see in a garage. Its purpose is exactly that, to depict a beauty and call it a pin-up girl. I think that was unusual, that was strange.
I mean, of course, there was a certain dishonesty in like salon painting in the late 19th century, where they would have a voluptuous female nude,
absolutely,
but
yeah.
it would be dressed up yeah. under a classical guise to excuse it. Whereas there's a tremendous frankness and honesty about this, saying, you know, you're a young man and you like looking at a naked woman, which of course became a little unacceptable as feminism yeah. appeared. But you were never attacked in the way that, say, Alan Jones or Tom Wesselman were. And I think that's because there's always a person there.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, Alan Jones so stylized the figure and often left the face out, and the same with Wesselman, that it can be seen as an objectification of the female body.
Perhaps they didn't notice me. Perhaps it was as simple as perhaps they overlooked what I was doing. I mean, what Alan was doing was pretty overt, wasn't it? It went under the radar, maybe, the feminist radar.
This idea about the fantasy figure occurs in other areas of subject matter as well, particularly all the paintings you've done of Tarzan and his family, such as this one, which you began in 66 and ended in 75. Then there are works such as these watercolors of 1984 of Arab women, this idea of the exotic, of looking at another culture. You're often very curious about different kinds of people, not only misfits and outcasts, but people from different parts of the world, people that you would never have met in your childhood or teens living in the outskirts of London, and who you knew in this case through postcards again, or through National Geographic magazine. Then there are the paintings and the watercolors based on Alice Through the Looking Glass and Alice in Wonderland, such as this mad tea party at Watts Tower, which is another painting which you spend many years on, starting in 1968 and finally finishing it in 92. I mean, what was happening in all those years with this painting?
It's a picture that just took a long time to paint. I mean, there's a lot of detail in the tiles. I mean, each one was painted individually. I think that this kind of painting simply does take a long time. It needs the hours to be put in.
You have an infinite patience. I mean, there are paintings that you began a long time ago and abandoned that are still in your studio unfinished and which you may never have the heart to return to. But on the whole, you've been quite tenacious and you go back to them.
Yes, they're
and
not
you do
abandoned,
eventually
they're
finish.
In progress.
In progress.
But you rightly say some of them won't get finished, but as far as I'm concerned at the moment, they're in progress.
This was 25 years in the making too, this Puck, Peas Bottom, Cobweb, Moth and Mustard Seed. You started in 1969, the year that you left London, yeah. and moved to Wiltshire, the beginning of your so-called ruralist period, and you didn't finish it until 1984, by which time you divorced your first wife, returned to London and remarried. That area of your work is perhaps the area that certain kinds of art world people have had the most difficulty with. Not necessarily this picture, but some of the other Shakespearean pictures, the Titania's paintings with fairies, which people see as whimsical or fey or cute. And I think even you have a little bit of discomfort with that period of your work now when you had the retrospective at Tate Liverpool 2 years ago. They were the works that seemed slightly out of kilter with everything else. Everything else seems like a continuous stream. And yet, the realm of the imagination that's depicted in these ruralist pictures is a very central part of your work as well.
Yes, and I think they fit in to a long tradition. I mean, one of the paintings I was very influenced in and interested was the Richard Dadd here in the Tate, Fairy Fellas masterstroke. I mean, I hope they fit in into that tradition, but also I also hope they fit in to the tradition we've talked before about, you know, the people in my paintings being like a kind of repertory company. You know, I mean, in fact, park here, the head is Del Shannon, you know, the pop singer.
Runaway.
Yeah, Runaway, yeah. And so you, the crossovers are still happening and the references are still happening. I suppose it was a strange decade anyway, that the years of ruralism. And I suppose the big change in the pictures came from the fact that Liberty was born in 68. So suddenly I was the father of a girl child and making pictures in a way for her, perhaps, you know. So, but we really, there won't be time to go into the ruralist years, but we really were attacked. And I suppose almost deservedly, because our manifesto, you know, one of the things I said was that, you know, sentimentality was a perfectly valid reason for painting. Well, at that time, I mean, that was an awful thing people thought.
Even now, people would probably only do it ironically, whereas you did it sincerely, which was more shocking.
Yeah, and I still would. I mean, I still feel, you know, that sentimentality is a perfectly valid reason for painting.
I mean, when you say you felt that the fairy painting of the Victorian painters was a tradition that you felt was a valid one that you could link into, it's hard to imagine any other artist of your generation who would have thought that that was a tradition that would be a good career move.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, if we get on to career moves, I've made some bad ones.
For example,
two examples. I mean, one was that I was in a mixed show in New York. I mean, you know these stories, but I was in a mixed show of British and American pop art in 1961 in New York, and got really terrible criticism.
This is the new realist at Sydney Janus.
Yeah, at Sydney Janus. Yeah, and unfair. You know, I felt unfair criticism. And I vowed then that I would never show in New York. I would never have a show in New York. And I didn't until kind of 4 years ago. And that wasn't smart. You know, to go through those years and not show in New York is a great gap in an artist's career. And the other one, which as it happened was neither here nor there, was that in the early days when Charles Saatchi was buying, for instance, when he bought the Schnabel show, you know, from Sydney Janus, not from Leo Castelli. I asked Leslie Waddington not to sell my work to Charles Saatchi because I felt he was a dealer and not a collector. That wasn't a great move at the time, I don't know.
We've spoken briefly.
Incidentally, it was hypothetical. He was never interested in it anyway. So should make that clear.
All right. We were speaking briefly earlier about your background in graphic design and the fact that throughout your life you've worked in the commercial sector as well as a fine artist. This painting of Jean Harlow from 1964 was commissioned as a cover for the Sunday Times magazine.
That's right.
And you've done quite a few of those during Sunday Times magazine only started the previous year, or 62 maybe.
Well, one of the other kind of crossover and links is that in 61, I won the junior prize in the John Moore competition. Ken Russell made Pop Goes the Easel, and it was the very first Sunday Times that I was in. And there's an article on my work in that first Sunday Times. So it's relevant to what you're going to say that.
Yeah. And then this is a screen print that you made in 1964 of the Beach Boys, which was part of a project from the Institute of Contemporary Arts, where they commissioned 20 artists to make prints. And the first of your screen prints, a medium that you've used many times over the years, and you chose to do it of your favorite American pop group, from an album cover, tracing the image. And then the image that everybody knows by you, the cover for the Sgt. Pepper album, 1967, which you're probably sick to death of talking about. And then there are many other album covers which have not been seen so much. This is the back cover for an album by Mick Jagger's brother, Chris Jagger, called The Adventures of Valentine Vox, the Ventriloquist, in 1974. And absolutely in the spirit of your work. And I think it was always a wonderful, generous notion of making something that really is an artwork that could be bought for a few pounds by people who wouldn't have had the wherewithal to buy a limited edition print or an original painting and still get the same aesthetic. This was the original artwork for the Band Aid single, Do They Know It's Christmas, in 1984. So both with Sgt. Pepper and with this single, you reached a massive, massive audience that most artists could only dream about. And although some artists might be sniffy about working in that medium, you never had a problem with that. For you, it was just another format for making your art. This particular one does go back to the Sgt. Pepper magic crowd idea. But what people often don't realize with Sgt. Pepper is that wasn't a collage, whereas the later one is.
Well, the magic crowd idea goes right back, as you know, to the very first collages, a group of collages about the circus, where the crowd is made up. And there wasn't that much material available. So there might be some cut-up photographs, there might be some cut-up engravings. So you get this kind of collage thing of different sorts of heads appearing out of necessity almost. And that would have been in the mid-50s. So it's gone on and still goes on.
And it's apparent also on the balcony and preparation for the
I think
the
what you were going to say or... about this probably was that it was built as a set, wasn't it? So without going into it too deeply, it wasn't a collage. It was a theatre set which we then photographed, whereas this was a collage.
And then Paul Weller's Stanley Road. When you make an album cover like this, or the one you did more recently for Brian Wilson, how much discussion goes on with a musician about the images that are going to go into it? Do they generally just leave you to it, or do they have ideas about particular subjects want?
If we take this as an example, I mean, I had a phone call from Paul Weller saying, "Would you do my record cover?" And I hadn't done one for some time, and I hadn't been asked to do one for some time. And I think he's such a fan of the Beatles that he probably thought, "Well, I'll call him. We'll see what happens." So then we had meetings, and it gets quite complicated, but the original idea was, this was quite early on in the times of CDs, so the outside border, which is an equal border, was to be a shallow box with a recession in the middle that the CD would fit into. So that image in the middle, which in turn is a picture of Paul Weller as a boy holding a picture of Paul Weller as a man, which is this kind of magic realist kind of concept again. And then we talked, and I thought, as he was the kind of... His title is the Mod Father, so he very, very much related to the target image, which we kind of share as a motif. So I thought I would give him back the target. So it's a very...
And of course, your friendship with Pete Townsend of The Who is link to musically for him as well.
The Who at one point called themselves the pop art band and referred to my work for their clothes at that point. For Pete wearing the jacket with badges on, the Union Jack jacket. So there is this musical crossover often.
Just going to touch briefly on the later work, because I'd like to leave time for questions. This is a painting you did after returning to London from Wiltshire and after a visit to Los Angeles, the meeting or Have a Nice Day, Mr. Hockney, in which Howard Hodgkin appears behind you as
As my servant.
As your servant, which I'm sure he was very appreciative of. And you're paying homage to David Hockney, and the whole picture is a parody of Gustave Courbet's painting, Le Rencontre, Bonjour, Monsieur Courbet. And then in the mid-90s, you were associate artist at the National Gallery from 94 to 96, and you made a lot of paintings during that period based on old master paintings in the permanent collection, but always with your own particular take on them. This is the exhibition of a rhinoceros in Venice. This is the Venus's outing to Weymouth, which is a kind of painted collage of Venuses from many different artists from the collection. And I think your sense of play, your playful humor comes across very strongly. And then more recently still, the Marcel Duchamp's World Tour paintings, which have been occupying you and which you're still, I believe, working on. The series isn't over. This is the artist's fancy dress ball. Would you like to just describe the different characters in this picture?
Yeah, this
is a detail, by the way.
The series is a kind of thank you to Marcel Duchamp for saying that anything an artist makes is therefore art. It's a debt that all artists owe to him. So I've sent him on a kind of perpetual posthumous tour on this tour bus with his name on the side, where nice things will happen to him all the time. I can paint the pictures. He'll be on this kind of posthumous tour with nice things happening. This particular one is, I think it's called the
artist's fancy dress ball.
Yes, and Marcel's got off the bus, and Damien Hirst is on the left wearing the clothes from the Watteau Gillis picture, which I referred to, the self-portrait. And Picasso is on the right wearing the clothes from a Zoffany painting. And then the little group in the middle are that Picasso Sautambique picture with Duchamp as one of them, Edward Hopper as another. And they're about to go off to a party. Do you have any of the others? In this one, he's playing chess with Tracy, and it's a group of people that changes all the time. So there's no explanation of the cowboys in this one, but they may well recur in a later picture. Rather camp cowboys, they might come back into the story.
Perhaps you should say a little bit about the tour bus and your experience of rock and roll tour buses.
Yeah, which is very pertinent tonight. We travelled for some time with the Everly Brothers on their tour bus, and after various gigs in London, we've gone back to hotels with the Wondermints and Brian Wilson, and I've travelled with Ian Dury. There's an interesting story about that, because a year ago I had a show in Brighton, and Chrissy said, wouldn't it have been nice to have come to Brighton on a tour bus? And Lance, who has CCA prints, called a month later and said, I bought a bus. And we said, what? And he said, yeah, you talked about having a tour bus. I bought one. And it's parked in front of the Tate tonight, the CCA art bus. So in a way, this whole kind of thing... I don't know whether we talked about this yet, but this whole thing of what I hope pop art might be, in a way, has come to a culmination that we went to Brighton on the tour bus about a month ago, arrived sitting on the balcony at the back, drinking champagne, with Fun, Fun, Fun playing very loudly from an outside mic, driving along the front at Blackpool, at Brighton, going to an exhibition. So in a way, what I was aiming for maybe has happened.
And inside the bus on the top deck, there is an exhibition of your prints?
At the moment, yeah. I mean, it's a gallery space. It's my prints. I've decorated the outside of it. The inside will change and have different artists. And it goes to schools, and it's a very it's a very interesting, good thing to have happened, but it came out of that slight conversation.
I just want to end. We've touched on your use of collage over the years. This is a knife throws board of 1957, which is a very unusual kind of collage. It was all the image of Brigitte Bardot was from the pages of a men's magazine, which you were meant to take apart and make into a big poster.
That's right, yeah.
Which you then collaged these knives onto. And then this is a museum for myself of 1977, which contains some of the memorabilia you've collected, signed photographs, postcards, various objects. And I think one could describe your whole life's work as a kind of collage.
Yeah.
Different methods, different things you've collected, many of which you've incorporated into the art. And where it really becomes visible is in your private domain of the studio. I visited Peter last week and took some shots, which I hope there are no thieves here getting ideas.
There's nothing to steal. It's all bits of wood and stuff.
But I'll just run quickly through these to give you an idea of this. I don't know what size would you say that studio is? How many square feet?
It's 3,500.
3,500 square feet. Absolutely packed with your own paintings, with collages in progress, sculptures in progress, collections of objects in various categories. It's a wonderful kind of playground in a way for all your interests over the years, and then collections within collections. And I think one gets a sense when visiting your studio of your head being absolutely full to bursting with all this imagery that you've enjoyed and looked at and collected and taken for yourself and used for your own means. So one day, perhaps this will end up being a museum somewhere, although you don't have plans for it.
No, it's my studio. It's where I go to work, and it's my environment. I mean, all artists make a nest, don't they? It's my nest.
But some artists would feel crowded by so much imagery made by other people, and you obviously feed off it and are inspired by it.
Yeah, I can turn it off. You know, somebody said the other day, what do you choose to work on? You when there's so much going on. And I can isolate it. I can just let the most important thing float to the surface and deal with that day and ignore the rest.
You're able to compartmentalize anyway, aren't you? Because you'll be either painting or making collages at another part of the studio, or making sculpture, or going to Coriander to work on prints.
Yeah. And it's very enjoyable to do that. I mean, I can work on a painting, and if I feel I want to move on from that, there's another room with collages set out. I mean, the big advantage of having this much space is literally that. I mean, in each room, there's a table that I can work at, so I can go anywhere within the studio and work. This is a collection of folk art, this particular bit. That's a room devoted to collage. I curated a show at Tate Liverpool of collage, and at the time collected quite a lot of things. So that's the collection of collage.
So you're never at a loss for what to do when you go to the studio.
Never,
there's always
no.
10 different projects on the go.
And if I really can't decide, there's always lots of cutting out to do for the collages. So I'll just find a bunch of cutting out and sit for half an hour and literally cut tiny things out.
I think we should give people a chance to ask questions now. We've gone on a bit longer than I was intending, so if you have something you're dying to ask, now's the moment.
It was very enjoyable for me. In a way, what you've done, which is brilliant, is given a lecture on me, which I'm which I can sit and listen to and enjoy. and occasionally interspersed.
Does that mean I talk too much?
No, it's fascinating. No, I enjoyed that.
Incidentally, the book is being sold outside. And Peter, I think, has agreed to sign copies. So it's a wonderful opportunity to do that as well. So,
how should we do this? Some microphones here.
Yeah.
Hi. The Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood were influential in your early life. And they seem to be coming back into vogue. There's a big series coming up on the television about them any week now, sort of thing. Could you say something about the way they did influence you?
Originally, it was a technical thing, I think. John Everett Millais particularly, it was just the skill that he depicted reality. I mean, with pictures like Ophelia. I mean, I would come to the Tate, And the Pre-Raphaelites used to be down in a kind of lower level, right at the back, and it was always empty. You could go through there and sit for an hour, and no one else would come into the room. And I would just go and learn how to paint, I think, from them. So I think that was the main interest. And then later, the subject matter would have become of interest. And a picture we didn't show tonight. I did a painting of Ophelia, where I took the two Ophelias that I like best, the Arthur Hughes and the Millais. And in my Ophelia, the Ophelia is sitting on the tree from the Arthur Hughes painting. It's the tree from the Arthur Hughes painting. The foreground are the flowers and the reeds from the Millais, and my Ophelia is in that moment between the two pictures. So she's fallen from the Arthur Hughes tree. She's stumbling across the water, but she hasn't yet sunk into the water and drowned. So I mean, it's this crossover of art and appropriating art is one interest, and the other was purely a technical thing. I was amazed how Millais could do it.
Your facility for collating and building, wouldn't montage and visio be a really exciting thing for you to go into?
It probably would. In case you didn't hear the question, is whether I've ever been interested to go into video. And I think it goes back a long time when the question would have been, why haven't you made a film? And at the time, it felt to me like a presumption. It was something you maybe had too much respect for films. I thought you can't just make a film. I'm not capable of making a film. So for years I just didn't go there. And I think it's pretty much the same with video now. Although I'm involved, I mean at the moment I'm involved with a new film on the Enduri that I'm doing the graphics for. I didn't ever feel the need or interest to actually make a video. And in fact, people didn't then. I mean, what very nearly happened is that I very nearly made the first pop video because I'd worked on a film in the West Country. There's a filmmaker called John Carlaw had made. And he said, I've had this idea. And he explained it to me, a way of kind of illustrating a song in film. And I literally didn't understand what he meant. And we went to visit Brian Ferry in Bristol and discussed it with him. And if we'd done it, it would have anticipated the first video, which was made by Queen. It would have been 6 months before that. So I nearly did. I'm not likely to now.
Do you remember what song that was? This was Roxy Music.
Yeah, it would have been just any song at the time. It was Roxy Music, so it wasn't a particular song. But I mean, what might have worked would have been later something like These Foolish Things. Mm-hmm. So I've illustrated songs and I've illustrated texts, but never made a film.
What you haven't said is that you have actually appeared in some blockbusters, haven't you?
I certainly have. I had parts in two of the Harry Potter films. One was just a view from the back, where I only knew it was me. I think I was wearing Peter O'Toole's old pigtail, so I could recognise that. And in the other one, I was a picture that came alive, wearing a kind of a tin hat, like the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz, and saying, "Get away from there, boy, we're trying to sleep," in a West Country accent.
Hi, I have two questions. One is, when will the next opportunity be for people to visit your bus? Because I missed it in Brighton and I'd love to visit it. And secondly, what do you think of phenomenon like Banksy, where he puts art in unusual places and changes it all the time and so on?
Sorry, I didn't hear the name you said.
Banksy.
Oh, you're right. The first answer is that the bus is outside, so I don't know how many people can go on it, but you certainly can see it. It's parked up in front of the Tate. Banksy, I think in a curious way, maybe that they've sold out a little bit. You know, I think now kind of street art has become an industry. And I admire what Banksy did and does, but I think they have to be careful that they don't become too much, you know, too kind of too much of an industry. I mean, graffiti and street art is meant to be on the street. It's not meant to be on a canvas to be sold for a lot of money. And I'm sure Banksy would absolutely agree with that.
Any other questions?
My question's more for the Tate, really. The retrospective that was in Liverpool, will that be coming to London at all?
I don't know whether to bring up my discontent. Is it too German? Well, I don't.
Not end on a sour note.
It doesn't matter anyway, and I don't want to be kind of whiny and miserable and grumpy and churlish, but I do feel slightly that I've been sidelined by the Tate. Not overlooked. They're very aware who I am, but. The Tate Liverpool show should really have been here, and I at the time I wanted it to be in Liverpool. I'm very fond of Liverpool, and I absolutely agreed that it went there. But an awful lot of people I talked to now didn't get to it, and it was a kind of, I feel now. I mean, it wasn't even the Year of Culture; it was the year before the Year of Culture. So I feel slightly that I was relegated. At that point, and that what Tate Liverpool needed at that point is a boxing analogy. The next year, 2008, was to be the Year of Culture, the big fight. They wanted a very strong undercard as a build-up to the big fight. Jake and Dinos had a show, I had a show. It was a very strong year, and I felt slightly slightly as though I'd been a commodity and used. And the other, just quickly, the other example is that Chrissy and I came into the Tate about 3 months ago, and we there was a show of collage on, and we went round it, and I thought, oh, there'll be one of mine in a minute, and there was nothing. and of all people, yeah, I mean, having curated a show of collage, and there was a lot of collage that I think I might have influenced, but I wasn't there. There was a room of pop art from the 60s. I looked around. Again, I wasn't there. There was a room of portraiture that I easily could have been in. And finally, there was a room of drawings from the Tate's collection. And again, nothing. There was nothing of my work up. And I think now, the self-portrait is up. I've never had anything shown at all at Tate Modern. And the other thing which I have to mention, which is slightly grumpy, but not, I'm not unhappy, that in Tate Modern there's a kind of family tree of art. And you know, I went there and looked along it. Pop art is there, Lichtenstein, Warhol, everybody. I'm not on it. I'm simply not there. And I couldn't believe that I wasn't there. And there were other kind of lesser pop artists. And so this came about because about a month ago, I had a phone call from a journalist saying, there's a pop art show in October. You don't appear to be in it. Would you be disappointed? And I mean, as it happens, it's not a show that I particularly should be in. So it's all fine now. But what I said was, I wouldn't be disappointed, but I wouldn't be surprised because I just don't seem to be represented anymore. Anyway, a month ago, suddenly my name has appeared on the pop art tree, which is... As I say, I'm not that unhappy about it. And I don't, in a way, I don't even resent it because the Tate is run in a certain way. If I don't fit into the scheme, I'm doing other stuff anyway. In a way, it doesn't matter. But I think all these things added up to a point where I did feel slightly discontented.
Peter,
but I'm not that unhappy about it.
Peter, I'm feeling slightly backed into a corner here.
Yeah. So, I hope you might be.
I'm very tempted to declare the end of the evening and we all go and have a drink. But I would say, and this is really very significant, I think, you are one of the very, very few artists who have had two Tate retrospectives. As you say, one in the early 80s, which was an extraordinary project. I remember clearly attending the opening myself and being absolutely thrilled to see you in conversation with Ian Dury and thinking that, celebrity had arrived at the Tate in a big way. It was an incredibly important show. And to have another show, albeit 20-plus years later, at the Tate, was a sign of your continuing significance in the unfolding story of British art. And as I think as this evening's conversation has shown, you do defy categorisation. You're not just a pop artist. You're involved in so many different endeavours, in so many different strands of British culture that it would be impossible to include you in every investigation of all of those strands. You are hugely admired by the Tate. We ourselves published a book about you quite recently, as you know. And I would say, Peter, you're a young man yet, and there's plenty of time.
To take those points, almost all the artists of my generation have had second retrospectives. I mean, my immediate generation, Richard Smith, Hamilton, Howard. In fact, Howard had his second retrospective parallel to mine, but at the Tate in London. It isn't that unusual to have a second retrospective. And I still feel it was a kind of relegation.
Well, I can't speak for my colleagues in Liverpool. I think they would be very sad to think that there was a kind of Tate hierarchy and they weren't near the top of it. They argued very strongly in favour of putting on the show there in Liverpool, and it was a huge success. And as I say, the story hasn't ended, Peter. You do play a continuing part in our BP displays every year. You are hugely appreciated by the curators here and clearly by the audience as a whole this evening. So yeah, I would just thank you.
We don't want to end on a grumpy note. As I say, in a way it doesn't matter, but a lot of things came together, and I suddenly thought, well, that. All these pointers happened at the same time, and it suddenly occurred to me, that something strange had happened. But it doesn't matter.
You did say, Peter, in 1997, when you turned 65, you were going to retire from the fray and not let these things upset you anymore.
Yeah, they didn't for a long time, but that did. So I think the other
but
thing...
But in the end, the work is what survives. And the attacks you had from the critics in the 70s are completely forgotten now.
Yeah.
And the work is still here and still being enjoyed by a very big audience.
Well, perhaps it's just it's a healthy thing that this has come out, I think. It's not a bad thing that it's been... It wasn't brought up by me. I mean, we meet often, don't we? And I meet Nick often, and I've never, ever grumbled. You know, I've never said, look, this isn't fair. Or it's just that this journalist brought it up, and I responded to it. And in responding, these things occurred to me. And I'm rather glad they've come out. But it is a kind of new start.
And I'm afraid time is ticking on now, so I'm going to have to draw the event to a close. But I would like you to all join us in the Claw, out in the Claw foyer for a glass of wine. As Marco said, the book is available. And also, please do go and enjoy the bus, which is the front of Tate Britain. So please join me in thanking Marco Livingston and Peter Blake.